Thanks for coming, everybody. I'm going to be talking a little bit about continuous deployment. It doesn't seem like a big topic, but I think I have enough time to fill 45 minutes here. We're going to be talking about how it impacts operations teams, which I'm sure most people here are a part of. And a lot of what I'm talking about is stuff that I've learned at Etsy in the last 16 months that I've been there. But it's also stuff that's practiced by a lot of other companies. Google does very similar things. Yahoo does very similar things. And a lot of other companies do. I'm hoping to encourage you guys to embrace this method of working. So as we go through this, hopefully you'll see that continuous deployment is much more than just using a particular piece of software. It's not just about using Deployinator. It's not just about using Capistrano or whatever it is to quickly get code out there. There's a lot more that impacts you and me when it comes to working this way. Okay, so a little very quick refresher on DevOps. Hopefully, you guys all saw Ben's keynote this morning. As a topic, it's fairly new, but it has roots that go back quite a long way. And if you want, you can go find out all about those. But a lot of us have been doing DevOps for years and years without actually calling it this. And a lot of people, when I talk to them about DevOps, they say, I don't know about this. It seems really complicated. I don't want it to end up like this. This is, I've only just finished cleaning up my cable management. I don't want DevOps messing things up in my process and flow and things. Well, they say there's too many moving parts. It's just there's too much to do. I don't have time for this. But those of us who have been doing DevOps and continuous deployment for several years now have come to realize that it's not that busy. It's not that doesn't have to be complicated. And in fact, we're really glad that the DevOps movement has taken off because it's allowed us to jump on this little hippie bandwagon and really get the word out that this is a cool thing and that everybody should be doing this. And so we're going to focus on a very small component of the larger movement, which is continuous deployments. First of all, I'm not going to try and convince anyone that this is easy. Continuous deployment is a very, very difficult thing to implement. It takes time, it takes effort, and it takes commitment from your management, from the operations teams, from your development teams. Everyone has to be involved in it. It's especially hard on developers who haven't had to do a lot of deployment to production. If you work in a small company, maybe you have developers who get to push code out and so on, but most developers generally don't seem to get to do that. So a quick poll first. How many people here don't get to spend their entire day doing things like capacity planning? Put your hands up, or keep your hands up, and keep your hands up if you don't get to do things like fixing those problems that have been on your to-do list for a month. Okay, good. Keep your hands up, and also put your hands up if you are tired of being like this guy and fighting fires all day long. Okay. Continuous deployment is really nice because once you get it implemented, you don't have to be this guy anymore. You actually get to spend time doing the other things that make systems administration so much fun, and the reason why we all really got into systems administration, which is to actually improve the system. So it can be done right. But what do we need to do in operations? Well, Nirvana, here we come. The first sort of step towards doing continuous integration and continuous deployment is to let go, which is probably the hardest thing that any operations team or any operations person has to do. We have to let go of a lot of control over the system. We have to let go of managing what code goes out, when it goes out, the release of the code. And we're just not used to it. We're used to having a lot of tight control. Developers come to us and say, hey, we've got this new package that has to go out. And we'll say, okay, well, we'll do it tonight at 2 a.m. or tomorrow at whatever time, and we'll let you know if there's any problems, but we'll take care of it from here. But really, we have to let go, because doing it that way, for a number of reasons, it just doesn't scale to start with. As your company grows, as you add more developers, of course you have to add more operation staff, but eventually this whole process kind of starts to break down. Developers will start developing faster. They'll get better at what they're doing, and better control and better process on their side will mean they have more releases for you, or larger releases for you. And eventually you'll just be doing nothing but releases all day long. And that's just not a fun place to be, trust me. The other thing is that letting go is okay, because just because you let go of one thing doesn't mean there won't be tons of other stuff for you to do. There's lots of work for systems administrators to do. And honestly, if your employers are sending you here, they understand this as well. This whole year is based around the concept of DevOps. So, you already have a little bit of buy-in there. And let's face it, if you're having developers pushing out code, that's a good thing, because they really understand the application more than you do. There's only so much that a developer can teach an operations person. You can go look at code, you can go read documentation, but when it comes down to really how the code pathways work and things, they understand them far better than you do. So when there's a problem, in theory, they should also understand much better about how to fix them. So another pass for sort of continuous deployment. But there's also security to think about. The other thing I hear when people talk to me about continuous deployment is they say, well, this means that developers get to push out anything they want. Yes. They say, well, developers need access to the production systems now. Yes. And they say, well, some of these developers are telling me they want root access on these systems. Yes. It's okay. It's not bad. You may have processes and controls in place that prevent some of these things from happening, but it's not the end of the world. If you think about it and you do it carefully and you plan it right, you can still have secure systems and allow developers access to the things they need to. Developers may need them for many reasons. We at Etsy, we have upwards of 100 developers, and most of them have access to the systems that they need to, in order to diagnose problems, debug things, look at log files, and help us find out what's wrong and then fix it. And it tends to work fairly well. But this is kind of scary. First of all, we've let go, and then we've opened up all these big security holes, and we're not too keen on this. But there is hope. It's not the end of the world. And hope comes in then regaining control. We've just given up control, you say. We've let all the developers in, and they're pushing all this code out, and we don't know what's going on, and what are we going to do? Oh, I was a little bit disingenuous, and it's not entirely true that you let your developers run wild. But as an operations team, we are a pretty critical part of any deployment process when it comes to it. That's not going to change. And continuous deployment isn't about pushing operations out of the way, and it's not about letting developers do whatever they want. It is about enabling people to work at their absolute highest potential. Developers are very good at developing. They understand the application very well, and so it makes sense that they should have and bear some kind of responsibility in making sure that it works well in production as well. Operations people, we're good at deploying code. We're very good at managing systems, large systems, scaling systems, capacity planning, and so on. And this is what we should be able to focus on. We still get the opportunity, like I said, to maintain servers. And we'll still have to work on making sure that these things can grow, that they're highly available, that they're reliable. And things will still go wrong. People will say, oh, I don't know why this code doesn't work in production. And they'll call us and they'll say, hey, Evelyn, can you come help me out? I don't know why I can't connect to some server or something. And that's normal. We're never going to be out of the chain. Okay. So doing that, we've sort of changed the goal of what the operations team is. Instead of being a block in the way of pushing code out and moving forward, we've sort of changed our focus. When we talk about regaining control, there are a few things that we can do. Some of these things take advantage that we can do to take advantage of moving forward. We'll go through each of these, except maybe with holding unicorns. I don't normally recommend that, but it can be kind of helpful if things go south. The first thing is to make sure that you have complete buy-in from your leadership. I've seen a lot of places try and implement continuous deployment and DevOps, and the management either isn't so keen on it, whereas you know developers or operations are really keen on it, or on the other hand, leadership doesn't understand what it is. So the very first thing to do, if you're thinking about implementing any of these concepts that we're talking about this week, is to talk to your leadership, whether it's your CEO, your CTO, your VP, whoever it is, and explain to them, you know, tell them what the benefits are and say, hey, you know, this is really going to help us. You know, we can move faster, but not just move faster, but we can move faster and keep things stable if we do it right. And you tell any management person that you can move faster and make more money while still remaining stable, you'll have them sold. It'll be easy. But it's up to us to get that buy-in. No one's just gonna give it to us voluntarily. The second tool that we have is policy. And most operations people I know kind of just don't like policy very much. It just kind of holds us back, it ties our hands, and just kind of gets in the way. But we can use policy to our advantage. When we start talking about things like continuous deployment, where developers are actually going to be pushing out code, you have to realize that most developers are not used to pushing out code. So while they might get very excited about it, they will quickly realize that there are a lot of things that they have to take into account too. And there's a whole talk I could do about, you know, the development side of this. But those developers are going to come to you, and they're going to say, okay, thank you for letting me deploy code. How do I do it? Well, there's a lot of different ways of doing it, but you really have to be the ones that come up and say, okay, well, this is the policy we have. This is how we're going to do it. These are the constraints that you have and the rules that we're going to set in place. And I've never come across a group that says, no, I don't like that. I don't really want any rules. I just want you to tell me how to push code to production. So it's good. People are generally quite open to writing documentation and so on. Another thing we do at Etsy is called operability reviews. And these are pretty simple things. It's usually a checklist of about 10 or 15 items. Developers will go off and they'll write their new feature set or their new code or whatever. And they'll come to us and say, hey, we want to push this out of production. And we'll say, well, go for that, an operability review. And they have to go and verify that their documentation's in place, that they have runbooks for when there are problems, and they can explain how each component works, and that monitoring's in place, and all the metrics gatherings is in place, and all kinds of other things, whatever, you know, happens to be useful for us. And I highly recommend those. Those are very good to do even if you don't do continuous deployment. Just having these things to work through, it gives a lot more confidence to the process. Another thing to think about is oversight of production. This is one thing that operations groups are very good at. You know, we set up the infrastructure. We understand it better than almost anybody. Occasionally, you'll run into problems with this, especially when you're trying to change the process. People may not understand, well, who's going to be in charge of production now? Who's going to be in charge of what? And what's everyone's responsibility going to be? That kind of stays with operations. We're still in charge of, you know, making sure things stay running, making sure there's enough capacity, making sure we're adding more capacity when we need it, making sure, you know, network setups are as optimal as they can be. And we really need to make that clear here when we talk about continuous deployment, that, you know, we don't just walk away. You know, developers, yes, you know, they've done their operability review, they have documentation, but that doesn't mean they can just get away with everything. It means that there's still oversight. If a developer happened to come along and say, hey, I have this great idea for a new database architecture, I'm going to get rid of all of our wonderful SQL stuff, Oracle, Postgres, MySQL, whatever it is, and we're going to start using, I don't know, Memcache for everything. Yeah, we don't need persistence. That's great. It's fast. Trust me, I'm not kidding. I've heard this before. And it's good because operations can sit there and say, what are you smoking? And it goes back and forth. And it's good to have this. And then finally, there's risk assessments. And I absolutely love risk assessments. Risk assessments is when, you know, it ties in very, very well with the oversight, is, you know, somebody will come up to you and say, you know, I've got 2 lines of code to deploy. And you say, go away, go do it. I don't need to be bothered for 2 lines of code or a logo change or something. Somebody else comes up to you and says, hey, I've got a new feature set, which is 20,000 lines of code, and it's never been tested before. It's like, well, go back and test it. But the question we often get asked is, if you have continuous deployment, how do you manage the risk of very large and sometimes non-code changes? And an example of that is, and if you look here on the red, doing network changes. You know, we're a good-sized company. We have our own network set up. We have our wonderful network engineer, and he has to make BGP changes and add new ISPs and things like that. We've got our DBAs who need to, you know, alter the schemas of the database. We don't do these things like continuous deployment. We don't do them 4 times a day because we understand that they are very high risk. So continuous deployment does have limitations as well. And trying to shoehorn everything into the system and saying, yeah, we'll just deploy it whenever we want. You have to be careful and understand and explain to others that you don't have to do it that way. These changes, these big deals, can be done once a week or on some other schedule. Whereas the other small things, like, you know, if I put up DNS monitoring and minor code changes, those are the kinds of things that we're comfortable doing every day. You know, making a DNS change is, if you test it, it's fairly benign. It doesn't really hurt anything if you test it right. So there are definitely limitations to those. So now we've changed our goals and we've changed our policies. Next, we're going to talk about tools. And if you've been following the DevOps movement much at all, you'll probably recognize at least some of these things. You know, everyone says, Gangly is great. We have to make more graphs. And various other things. There's Fitbit up there, Moonin. And we'll talk about some of these. So metrics are something that, if you're going to do continuous deployment, even if you're not, but especially if you're going to do continuous deployment, metrics are the things that will save you time and time again. The number of places I have seen where, you know, people say, hey, you know, I have my monitoring set up. If something breaks, I'll find out. But they don't have any trending data on how many exceptions their code is generating or how many 404s they're hitting. And they don't know when they push out code that something's broken or something's misbehaving or not behaving quite right. And starting early and getting your metrics into something, some kind of graph, is really important. At Etsy, I counted this morning, and we have upwards of 300,000 different unique metrics. And we don't have any especially beefy hardware to monitor these. We don't need it. We have our Ganglia box with a lot of disk space and some fast disks, and we have our Graphite box, and we use them for different purposes. We use Graphite for our business metrics, and we use Ganglia for pretty much everything else, for sort of application monitoring, application metrics and system metrics. In Ganglia, we have, about 60, 70,000 metrics, and the rest are all in Graphite. And it's very easy to set this up. You know, you add a system to Graphite, and you instantly have about 20 metrics right there. You can add more. You know, you add a database server, you should have at least 30 or 40 metrics about query rates, cache hit rates, number of disk IOPS being used, all kinds of things. Getting these things done early, and preferably before you implement continuous deployment, is a real bonus. Tools like Fitbit can help provide dashboards and consolidating some of these. We don't scroll through 300,000 graphs when we need to find something that's wrong. Dashboards come in really handy. There's another very good dashboard for Graphite called Pencil, written by Pete Fritschman, who I believe is over at Mozilla. And that's definitely something to look at. The other tools, monitoring, of course, very important. You know, it kind of has to go without saying. But your monitoring has to improve. It's not just, you're not just checking, is my site up or down? Now you actually have to check how your site performance changes. You can pull data out of Ganglia, out of Graphite, and see if it's changed recently. You know, you just did a deployment. Has your error rate gone up? Yes? Okay, good. Alert someone. Wake somebody up. The other thing that's cool about monitoring, especially if you're going down the DevOps route, is that you can use monitoring for more than just operations stuff. For example, recently we started working with our search team. There's about 6 to 10 people. And they said, hey, you know, we want to start monitoring some of our stuff. We have Elastic MapReduce jobs that run. We have index builds that run. But we don't really have a good way of knowing when they fail. Can you help us? And we said, yeah, we got this great thing. It's called Nagios. Come on, let us show you. And they love it. They think it's great. They think it's amazing that they can be told when things break. And they're like, wow, we've been only doing this for like 20 years now. And the biggest advantage that comes out of something like that, which we didn't even realize, is that when they start using our tools, I call them our tools, but you know, they start using operations tools like Nagios or whatever monitoring system you have, they're more keen to keep using those tools when they have to start deploying to production. They don't mind so much when you know they have to go acknowledge an alert, or they don't mind so much when they have to get paged because they're used to this, because they get paged for their own stuff already. So getting your developers involved and seeing this stuff is good. In fact, I think right now, maybe as many as a third of our Nagios alerts don't even page operations at all. They don't wake us up. They don't come to our emails, our pages, anything. They just go to development teams. If development teams need help, if this is a production problem, they know how to call us. We have pager addresses. We have on-call people. But we let them deal with the initial first response. The other kind of cool thing that you know Jesse mentioned earlier, if anyone was here in the talk just before this, Jesse Robbins mentioned John Allspar's Postmortem Foo. If you have the opportunity to go watch the video for that, really do. It is amazing. But having postmortem meetings whenever you have a problem, it kind of instills a confidence in people that you know we're gonna do continuous deployments. We're going to move fast, but we're gonna make sure that we do it in a responsible way. It's okay to deploy 20 times a day, but if one of those deployments breaks, we should go back and find out why and make sure we don't do it again. And the postmortem meetings that, you know, the ones we have at Etsy are never about assigning blame to anyone, which is kind of a culture change for a lot of organizations, I know. But they're really useful to have. And you don't just have them when something goes wrong. You know, you don't just have them when you have a 10-minute site outage or when a server blows up or something. You also want to have them for near misses. Because most of the stuff you'll learn about, you know, when things are going to go wrong and what's going to happen is out of these near misses. And you have a lot of these. We all do. You know, we accidentally fat finger a command and, oh, almost turned off spanning tree. And it happens, you know. I've done plenty of these. I have a near miss at least 3 times a week. But it's good to learn from these things, and they're just as valuable when you do them for the near misses as if you do them for actual site outages. Okay. So let's recap a little bit. We've let developers have their way. They get to deploy. They get to push code out whenever they want, and they're doing it responsibly and safely. We've changed our access to our systems. We've reviewed our security policies. And we've made sure that we understand that operations are not the only people using these systems. So developers have access to them and so on. We've changed our goals. We're moving faster than we were before. But we're doing it responsibly and trying to keep it stable. We've set up metrics. We've set up monitoring. We've gotten developers involved in this stuff. And now our hands are sort of freed of having to keep such a tight grip on these things. Eventually, you have to trust your developers a little bit. And we've changed the way, you know, like I mentioned, we've changed the way we've done monitoring and so on. And finally, from all of this, from doing all of this, we've increased our cap for success. Operations is often a huge bottleneck in a company. I've never been at a company where someone said, those operations guys, all they do is sit around all day and play Doom. I have been at companies where the operations guys are working ridiculous numbers of hours, trying to keep things running, trying to keep things stable, and developers are often waiting for operations to have some cycles free to do things. And if we distribute this load up to a larger team, then that frees us to be able to do many, many more useful things. If you manage to pull any of this off, if you manage to make any of this a success at your company, I invite you to come help me hunt for unicorns, because that's the only thing that's more difficult than this. If you'd like to hear more about continuous deployment, if you think this was, you know, this is something that shows promise, it's something that could help you, help reduce the burden on you, there's going to be a great talk tomorrow. Some of my colleagues from Etsy will be talking about a tool we open sourced recently called Deploynator, which is designed to help you do, you know, one-click deploys basically to production, but also do them in a very safe way. It's called being smart, being stupid to be smart, and that's tomorrow morning. I'm a little early. Any questions? No questions? Oh, some questions. Hello.
Hi. Hi. David Williamson, Microsoft Tell Me, I guess is the phrase these days. So I want to challenge one thing you had in here.
Mm-hmm.
Most of this was really awesome. I appreciate the talk. You talked about networking changes. You just kind of, I know it's a talk, so it's kind of high level, but you just kind of painted this broad brush of networking hard. For most modern service developments that I've seen recently, networking is an integral part of the service. A lot of what you've talked about sounds like it's really focused on deploying code. I personally have started thinking more about deploying services in their entirety, so code, networking config, system resources, whatever you need. So I want to challenge you a little bit on networking. I think it'd be useful to start thinking about networking as part of that service and assessing the risk of different types of networking changes, because certainly large-scale BGP change, that's probably in that red right-hand part of your bar. I'll buy that, but basic load balancer changes, adding new VIPs, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Clearly way to the left. So I don't know if that's something you've addressed.
Absolutely agree. So I tend to make a load balancer change whenever it's requested. We add pools to machines to pools, we change VIPs, we add VIPs. These things, like I mentioned, they are very low risk changes. We've done them so often that we're comfortable with them. And if we do them wrong, things aren't really going to break. And that's kind of our bar for things, right? It's like, if I do this and it goes wrong, will the site go down? Nope? Okay, it's probably okay. So, and yeah, it really is. And it's different for everybody. It's, you know, and this is kind of the cool thing that I like about DevOps is there isn't any sort of rigid structure that says, you have to do this, you can't do that.
Just as a quick follow-on, do you guys use any sort of automation around your network configurations, or is that all kind of manually added as part of a deployment?
It's mostly manual. We are starting to do some automation on that front, and it's kind of, it's a case of sort of looking at what we have and getting comfortable with it and making sure we feel right with it. I mean, I'm not going to push out some new tools or scripts or something that go and do crazy things like turn up switches and so on until I'm comfortable with them. So,
Thanks.
Thank you.
So some of this may be a little more obvious, but you're in a website, obviously.
Yes.
It used to be a social networking site, so a lot of this stuff makes a little more sense because you can actually do rolling changes and things like that.
Yep.
I'm not all that convinced that allowing the devs to do continuous deployment in a small enterprise shop is actually necessarily a good thing. It just, I have not seen any real reason for them to do these changes outside of, you know, during production hours.
Yeah.
Then again, we have production hours. You guys have 24/7. So everyone says, you know, continuous deployment is a nice theory. I'm still trying to understand why I might want to let my devs put a change in that could actually, you know, that requires a restart of an application server to take effect, and that would mean an actual outage for a financial client.
Absolutely, and this is, again, you know, goes back to what I was saying a moment ago, is that you don't have to necessarily do that, right? So you can break this down. There's, you know, there's people who do continuous deployment, and there are other people who I've spoken to who only do the continuous integration part of it, which is constant testing and constantly pushing code up to their master branch in preparation for the next release. There are other companies who, perhaps like yourself, who say, no, we're not going to do that at all. We're going to have, you know, very large code reviews. We're going to do this piece by piece, and we're going to have a lot of process and flow around this. And really, you have to decide what's good for yourself. If anyone tells you that continuous deployment is the right thing for everybody, they're lying. You don't want, looking at your organization, you know, a financial institution, it's probably way worse for you to have a minute of downtime than it is for me to have a minute of downtime.
They get cranky. Let's just put it that way.
Hmm?
They get cranky.
They get cranky, yeah. I mean, our shell has come back, and we don't like downtime. We try everything we can to avoid it. But, yeah, our guys come back. Your guys lose actual serious money.
I mean, my last job was a social networking site, so it's very applicable to what you guys are doing.
Exactly. And a lot of this has come from, you know, people who do web engineering, who work for websites and things. But then again, some of these things, you know, hopefully maybe components of this can be applied to other industries, and I hope they can.
And in fact, we're actually looking at continuous integration and then even incorporating that into the infrastructure side. So.
Yeah. So there you go. Perfect.
So is Etsy required to follow PCI compliance? I notice you take money, so.
We do take money. So how can I put this? We don't store any financially sensitive data, for example, credit card numbers, because all of our transactions currently are done through third parties like PayPal. So we don't. But having looked a lot at PCI stuff, a lot of the shops that do PCI have some kind of they do it one of two ways. They either have their entire infrastructure be PCI compliant, or they have the component of their infrastructure that deals with this sensitive data, such as credit card numbers and so on, be PCI compliant, and the rest of their infrastructure being not compliant, and that's generally allowed and accepted. So they, people don't do continuous deployment for the PCI component, whereas they do it for the rest of their architecture, and then they have to find some kind of balance for that. Yeah.
I effectively work for a payment processor, so.
Yeah,
everything's PCI compliant.
Everything's PCI compliant at that point. What are you going
to
do?
So I have to have clear defined, devs can't go here.
Does that include, for example, all your monitoring systems and so on?
To some extent, because the monitoring systems are also jump hosts, and they are explicit trust in the network for doing
that makes
pretty
sense.
Much what
I've Like I said, I hope that some of these can start being applied to environments like PCI, because a lot of the payment processes that I've spoken to, the people who work at the payment processes say, yeah, it'd be really nice if we could push out changes and features more quickly. But then you have to balance the risk, and if you do more testing, if you have, when we do continuous deployment, we don't just click a button and have code go out to production. We click a button and code goes out to our QA environment. A Jenkins job kicks off automatically, does, many, many unit tests, come back and says, okay. We click another button, it goes to our staging environment, same thing happens, it goes to production, finally. So, it's not one click, it's really three clicks. So there's a process, and there's many places there where we can catch errors and things like that. So at least maybe even incorporating those steps before you actually push to production can be used as part of, testing your code and seeing how well it does actually work.
Do you have a live QA team, or is it?
No.
Is it just?
We do have people who do QA type things, but most of our QA and testing is done internally by developers and automated testing with Jenkins and things like that.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Cool. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Stephanie from Big Fish in Seattle. So you made the comment of devs removing things like databases and replacing them with Memcache.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, how do you deal with the issue of, let's say, a new service needs to be live? Like code, that's one thing. Website changes, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But a new service is going out. Did you guys find that you're just working more closely with the devs in the beginning to make sure that what they're about to deploy is solid? Or how did you solve that piece?
Absolutely. So we have, our ops team is probably about 7 people, 8 people now, maybe 10 people. It's grown, actually. We do work very, very closely with developers, and it's a two-way thing. To start with, the senior technical management, that's sort of like our CTO and the tech leads and so on, they plan out the features and things that we're going to deploy in the future. There's a calendar for these kinds of things. And then we have, for the very major changes, for example, a few months ago, we made a very significant change to the way we display search results on our site. We also introduced the ability to buy ad space on our site to advertise your own products. And we had operations people working pretty much from the beginning with development teams on these features. And the operations guys generally didn't have to do very much, but these questions came up, like, you know, Etsy uses a lot of master-master MySQL servers, and the guys said, hey, do we still want to do this for this service? And is it the best thing to do? Do we want to do something else? And so the operations team was able to really get in there and help and kind of direct things in the way that we think they should go. Like I said, it's back and forth. We work with developers, and developers come to us and say, hey, you know what? We're thinking about making a significant change. We should talk to the operations guys because they know how infrastructure runs in the real world. So,
got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest balance, is to figure out how to teach the devs what is really a big infrastructure change and what's not.
It's
but it's
a
just
going to
be a training process.
It's just an ongoing educational process. I mean, I won't pretend that we don't have, you know, things that go out that, and later on we think, you know what, we really should have talked about this before.
Why is this singly home to a single server?
Well, yeah, exactly, right? I mean, we have those things happen. This isn't some kind of magic bullet that's gonna fix everything. But we have managed to reduce those things, and it has been a process of education. And part of it has been sort of self-taught for the developers themselves when they start working with production more, and they start getting woken up at 3 a.m. because their services are broken, and I'm still fast asleep. They realize that they can't always, you know, do the things they want.
They have to look at it.
They have to look at it in a bigger picture. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, Don Roper from Comcast. How do you handle failed deployments?
We have a roll forward policy. We consider doing rollbacks in the event of a problem, but because most of our changes are so small, it takes just as much time to correct the problem and repush a new deploy as it does to actually roll back. It actually probably takes less time. Most of our deploys that I see are, you know, a handful of lines or a couple of dozen lines or something. And the deploy process to go from our staging environment to our production environment, we had it down to 5 minutes, took it down to 2 minutes. I think it's less than a minute now to get out to probably close to 100, 150 servers, something like that. And that's part of actually the deploy nerd talk tomorrow. We'll go on and talk about that a little more. So the deploy, the component that actually does the pushing out of code, is so quick that we can spend the time to go and actually fix the problem and quickly push out more code.
Like the previous gentleman that spoke, I also work for
okay,
the...
Okay, very quickly, this is... Duncan has said this has to be the last question.
So.
Sorry.
I also
come find
work
me
for
afterwards.
The financial services industry, so our customers get cranky, to say the least,
okay.
When they experience downtime.
Yeah.
cranky people get fired cranky, but hey, it happens. So I like the idea of continuous deployment because I think it really kind of drags dev into the ops world and gets them used to, like, this is the effect that your code has. You need to make it reproducible and reliable. You need to make it easy for the ops guys to go ahead and install. Currently, what we do is we have a test environment, and dev goes and submits it to ops through a change request and says, go ahead and push this out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you think there would be utility to go drag dev into the ops world by saying, no, you're going to go ahead and do this, but you have to use the ops tools to kind of get them used to eating their own dog food.
Absolutely. And I think there isn't one tool, but there's a collection of things, right? So like I mentioned, the monitoring is, for us, it has been a very key component. We make developers wake up at whatever hour that things go wrong. We use PagerDuty.
Mm-hmm.
We fire off an alert, and it... Mm-hmm. SMSs people, and if they don't answer, it starts calling people. If they don't answer, it wakes up the entire tech lead team, and then people get cranky. So, our CTO doesn't like being woken up at 3 a.m. So developers get good at this. And that's been one way of dragging them in. The other way has been to show them that, like with the metrics that we use, you know, like I said, we have 300,000 metrics. I may look at 100 graphs, 200 graphs in a week at various different points, you know, trying to measure, you know, this system compared to this system or whatever. But the developers really see the benefit in this. Once you start showing them and once you start, you know, you initially you may have to add all these graphs for them and say, look, I'm adding all these things for you. Look how cool they are. They're great. It doesn't take very long at all. It very, very quickly they start to see, hey, you know, I have graphs for these 20 things in my system. I'm, you know, these other 30 things would benefit from graphs as well. Then I'd be able to tell where my performance is lagging, or I'd be able to tell when, you know, I'm going to reach some capacity limit or something. And I found that for us, that's been the key thing. But there's probably more.
Thanks.
Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.